May please pour on that before it sets the argument for decision. The problem we have initially in this case is what do we do with Benight, the Benight case? We have Reed Tool in place since 1985, but before that we had the Benight case. And so there is some question of what do we do with Benight? And what is the standard now for this case? I represent a woman who has moved her consortium in a workers' compensation situation, and she's alleged intentional tort. By our pleadings, we've also factually alleged what would constitute an assault. So what standard do we use? Well,
are you saying those two cases can't be reconciled?
Yes, I think they can, sir. Your Honor, I'm about to try to do that.
All right, well, that's your thrust. It's not that we overrule Reed Tool.
Yes, sir. Benight has not been overruled, although it has often been ignored as standing out there. I believe we have a Benight case before the court, but I'm trying to put these two cases together and make them read together. Reed Tool gives us this standard. Intentional failure to furnish a safe place to work, element one. But element two, which Reed Tool wanted us to certainly have, was the employer believes his conduct is substantially certain to cause the injury. Reed Tool was in fact, and we add that element being present. But then we have Benight sitting there. And in Reed Tool, the court said, Benight is limited to its facts. All right, what do we do with Benight then? Benight is an assault case. And I would suggest that Benight is really an application of the Reed principles in a specific assault situation. Because assault, you're going to have elements you're going to have to show. And in Benight, they required the employer in the submission, required the employee to work in an unsafe condition against her will when the employer knew of the unsafe condition. I would submit to the court that is showing that as the Reed standard, the second element Reed, that is showing that the employer believes his conduct is substantially certain to cause the injury. So the case is harmonized real well. If you're in an assault situation, I suppose, Your Honor, the way to say it is there's a Benight corollary to the Reed case. If you're in an assault situation, there's additional elements you're going to have to show simply because you have to prove an assault. And that's what Benight really tells us.
Some jobs are just dangerous. Can't an employer send his employee to do a dangerous job?
Your Honor, there's no doubt of that. And that is true. And that is the balance act we find ourselves in this case. The initial question in Reed was, here we have decided in Reed 1 that this cause of action is constitutional. Over here, though, we have a blanket of immunity to the employer. How do we balance it? And that's the trick of Reed 2. And that's why this is a tough case. And I'm not coming to this court saying this is going to be easy for anybody out there. You have two really hard elements. You're going to have to not only show that there is intentional failure to provide a safe place to work, you've got to take the extra step to show that there was an intentional failure, an intent on the part of the employer to set up a situation which substantially certainly caused the injury. It's hard. It's very hard. And I think the facts, what you're referring to, sir, is a fact, that's going to be part of the facts of the case. And that's going to be part of the substantial certainty to cause injury. That's going to have to be taken into consideration by the jury.
So you say there's a fact issue as to that?
Yes, sir.
In this case.
And that is why we're here. We have a summary judgment which we have suffered against us, saying we have no genuine issue of fact. I would say to this court that what Benight really is holding down, that if we can show the Benight situation, we as a matter of law do have a genuine issue of fact.
Benight was an assault by Bass, is that right?
Yes, sir, it was.
I don't see any assault here.
The assault, we look at Benight in the underlying theory of Benight, and Benight tells us that he took this lady by his knowledge, against her will, and put her into an assault situation. Assault being the, as I recall, the element, the apprehension of bodily harm is also an assault. Not just the physical striking, but the apprehension of bodily harm is also recognized as an assault.
I think striking is a battery, and the assault is the apprehension of the battery.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. That is true. And what we're saying here is with Rodriguez, what has happened, when he stood there in Rockport talking to Mr. Cameron, which is the ultimate supervisor, before he was going to drive the truck, and said, this is dangerous, these tires are worn, it is going to blow out. That's in the deposition. This tire will blow out. And his response, it's an unfortunate response. But the unfortunate response was, and I'm quoting him, because it's kind of a sad response, is, you damn Mexican, all you ever do is bitch. Unquote. Get in the truck or walk. That's a very sad response. So what they're telling him, that was saying his protestation, is drive the truck anyway. And so he places him in apprehension of bodily harm. And that's how we approach it, Your Honor. That's how we see the assault.
What's the difference between a truck with bad tires and the lathe that was called Jaws in Reed 2?
Factually, I don't think that's where the real distinction is in this case. I think you're right, Your Honor. That's pretty close. I think the real distinction with Reed 2 is Reed 2 never really laid a hand on evidence on the employer knowing this is a dangerous condition, knowing that he was putting this person in apprehension of bodily harm. That's where the Reed 2 petitioner fails. But one thing about Reed 2, and this is why I was submitting to the court that Reed is being overread. Reed is being overread. There was no summary judgment response filed in Reed. And so we're very thin on petitioner's facts for that reason. And in Reed, we don't have anything in there that says, I, the employer, know there's a dangerous situation. I know I'm putting that person in there beyond their will. Not present in Reed. And that's why I think the court turned it down. I believe that our case, the Rodriguez case, is the case that this court is looking for to satisfy Reed. We do have evidence of the employer knowing this is a dangerous condition. He was told to hire the blow out by his employee. Yes, he slurs the employee. He forced him to, drive and walk. We can all imagine that condition out in the middle of the country in an oil field situation. It puts him in danger. So we have a statement of intent. And by the way, I would submit to the court, that's the best evidence of intent is someone's statement. This person has, this shows an inference, and the summary judgment gives me the inference of malice and ill will for this human being. It's a terrible thing.
What do you have to show about the condition of that tire? Apart from just the subjective opinion of your employee as stated prior to the accident.
Yes, Your Honor.
What have you shown in the summary judgment record, and what more could you show at trial?
By request of production, we requested the tires. They're gone. The spoliation doctrine, which is cited in our motion for summary judgment, would infer that's not a good thing we can see there. Unfortunately, we never were able to get our hands on these tires. They're gone. So all we have, Your Honor, is our client's deposition. And frankly, that's it. That's all I can have. We try to get the tires.
And when you testified about the tires, that they were bare, that the inner tube was showing or something like that, didn't you?
Yes, Your Honor. And you have to, this is kind of a difficult, tricky part for me, frankly, is we're talking about two sets of tires, the front tire and the back tire. And there's two blowouts going on here. Blowout number, when he refers to the front tire, he's talking about a tube. You can see the tube looking out and the cracks in it. The front tire blows out. And then later they switch one of the back tires, it's a dual axle, it's a single axle with dual wheels, one of the back tires onto the front layer. Then we have the second blowout. And frankly, this is difficult for you to keep up with it. We have the second blowout, which rolls the truck entering the client. He also commented to him that there were cracks in the back tire. So there's pretty good information getting to this employer. He tells them the tires are bad, this truck will have a blowout, there are cracks in the tires, and he makes that statement. That's the employer's response. Strong evidence of their intent to injure. And I get the inference, since it's a summary judgment situation. And this somewhat sounds like a jury argument, but should be one. This is something the jury is going to have to decide whether this is enough to be an intent to injure.
You just said there's a fact issue.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you a question. You say that the bad tires amount to gross negligence. And then you say that the statements regarding of a racial character amount to turning the gross negligence into an intentional tort. Okay, now I don't find it in your brief, but I find it in the other brief that after the first blowout, the driver, your client, contacted his employer, and the employer came and then followed him for a period of over an hour at speeds of 20 to 25 miles per hour. Now, how would you say that affects his actual intent to see your client injured, since he was following at a very slow speed to make sure nothing happened?
Okay, so that's two ways, sir. First, you have the intent to injure has already been stated previously by the employer, by Mr. Cameron, the first instance. Now, you come to a second instance, which you're speaking of, where Mr. Wallace, another supervisor from the company, appears. Now, there is a conversation in the deposition between my client and Mr. Wallace, where my client said, this is illegal. This moving of there's four tires in the back. The moving of one of the tires from the back to the front is illegal. My client told him that. They said he did not want to do that. And this gentleman's response, it was not quite as how do I want to say, difficult or quite as vicious, was do your best. but his orders were to do it. And that second supervisor, Mr. Wallace, refused my client's desire to call for a new tire. And so by that, I'm saying that is a continuation of the first intent to hurt this human being. Put him in a position where he's substantially certain that something is going to happen.
Well, refusing to call for a new tire, you can equate to gross negligence, but you're relying upon oral statements to establish intent of mind. Okay.
Exactly, sir.
Okay, and when Wallace came along and made sure that he followed the driver for over an hour at a very slow speed, doesn't that negate part of your intent?
It's something for the jury to consider, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. What we have is a situation here. Of course, we don't have the viciousness of Mr. Cameron's first statement. Mr. Wallace basically says the same thing, but he's not sure about it. He tells him to get in the truck and drive. You're out in the middle of the country. This man has very few options. And over his protestation, he's forced into the situation to drive. We go back to the Benight case, sir, and we don't find a viciousness there of state of mind, but what we do find is the employer placing the employee into the dangerous position without all this intent of viciousness of state of mind. I'm really pointing to Mr. Cameron's statement because it's such strong evidence. It's such strong, it's best evidence. It gives me the genuine issue of material fact that I need to overcome the summary judgment. Let me say this. At this point, operating with freedom tonight, I'm not asking this court to change any law at all. This does not do anything to the law. What it does for us out there practicing is it cleans up, at least in my life, what I've got to have to get to a jury. I better have this. I better have this strong kind of intent evidence. It's placing the person in danger after they've rejected. I guess that would be, if this court found the way we hope it by, I guess that would be the Rodriguez corollary, is that you will survive the summary judgment on intent if you have the no, I don't want to do that, that's dangerous, and you put them in that position, in that apprehension of physical harm.
Doesn't that happen all the time, counsel? I mean, any dangerous job an employee might say, I don't want to do it, and then if he's hurt, is your theory that would be action?
Your Honor, I have to say that would be part that the jury has to decide as part of the job. That's a difficult question, and I say that it is.
Distinguish for me, if you will, between an intent to go do a difficult job and an intent to injure. In other words, there would be an intent on the employer in this case to hurt Mr. Rodriguez because they were mad at him for some other reason. So they said, we'll fix this fella, we'll put him in a truck with bad tires, and hopefully it'll kill him. Now, is there any evidence of that second kind of intent in this summary judgment record?
Judge, the only evidence we have is real of maliciousness to harm this human being is twofold. It is the statement by Mr. Kennedy. We've got that. But the inference is mine in that we're in a summary judgment situation. That would be a question the jury has to decide. Does Mr. Cameron want to hurt this human being? Or place him in a place where he's substantially certain to have injury?
But for the purpose of hurting him as opposed to the purpose of getting the job done.
Your Honor, that's the
difference. Or is there a difference?
Well, we're talking about a situation which really doesn't exist for me. Mr. Rodriguez, according to our evidence, drives a truck. He is not hired on to drive a truck with less wheels than the law requires. He's not hired on to drive a truck with thin tires. That's not in his job description, if you know. I can see a different case, a very different case, if you have somebody who's in a dangerous line of work. I can see situations where I don't want to go to the hypothetical because others will do that for me, but I can see those situations where the law might be different there. But this is not inherently dangerous work to drive a truck.
How do we distinguish between the two?
I think what we'll have to do is look at the nature of the job. What is dangerous? What did this person hire on for? What is dangerous in this situation? I'm trying to grapple with it. I see the problem. But that's not Mr. Rodriguez's problem. That'll be another case. Mr. Rodriguez did not hire on to drive tires that are cracked and tips again. And our law has to be able to apply out in the country, too. This man standing out in the country is only driving in the middle of South Texas. What's he going to do?
Counsel, a good example is welders who work on high-pressure gas lines. They have to go down in a hole. They know the line is thin. It's already leaking. So that's a dangerous job to go in there and do it. But that job can be made less dangerous if they take all the gas out of the line, just turn the gas off and get the pressure off the line. Then the job's not quite so dangerous. But if they send the man down there while the gas
is at 2,200 pounds per square inch, and sent him in that hole and said, you got to work on this pipeline, it blows out and kills him. That's your situation, you say.
I think of an example, which I, and that is a good example, I think of an example which I'm very familiar with, is a gentleman getting, he's out cleaning the building with a high pressure hose, and the electricity is on the line in the building. And he walks up to his employer, and I'm just taking this as a hypothetical, calls the electrical company and tells them to turn off the line. Which is, by the way, with this, as we've seen in the recent case of the Supreme Court, is a very good idea. Tell them to turn on, tell them to work on, tell them to shut it off. The employer says, no, I'm not going to do that. You get on up there anyway, or you lose your job. Even worse, maybe in my circumstances, you're 40 miles out of the country. Walk off. You walk off. He goes up there and he's electrocuted. I don't think he signed up for that. I think he protested and was placed in danger. I think that's the kind of illustration that we're looking at. That's the kind of thing we'll have to consider.
Are you satisfied to rely on the test that we set out in REAP 2?
I am, Your Honor. I am satisfied. However, I'd like to have the opportunity to make a Learned Justice Levy's argument in the dissent. I'm satisfied that REAP 2 will work in my case. REAP 2, by the way, I believe is working benign. REAP 2 can reach back to the benign facts and come up with the exact same conclusion. REAP 2 is pretty solid in the way it applies. And REAP 2 works well. Let me say why, though. I don't know if people claim on the defense of REAP 2 today, but REAP 2 works well because it balances the constitutional right over here of the client's bringing the cause of action versus the needs of the workers' compensation laws to protect employers and evenly balance out the risk. REAP 2 is a good balance. I'm saying let's defend the balance. And if we start saying that every time one of these cases come up, we're going to get shot down, we can't get past summary judgment, the balance might get out of whack. We have the case that we was looking for. We have the employer knowing of the danger, knowing of the opposition, and knowing that this person could be in a place where he would be substantially certain to be injured. Now, the majority of the court appeals hold, and this is problematic for me, they hold that he had no, they know that he had knowledge of the blowout coming. It was the last comment made. That he had knowledge of the blowout being on the way, but not knowledge of the specific injury. I think that is a distinction without difference. Let's say that I know that I'm going to put a man in a truck. We have expert affidavits on file saying that this is sure to happen. When you take one of those wheels off the back of one of these heavy trucks, this rollover is sure to happen. And I don't know that when it rolls over, this human being can be hurt. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense on the roads of South Texas or any other place. That simply does not make sense. Benight addresses that. Benight tells us that we don't, of course, restate the law, that we don't have to necessarily proceed to exact injury. We're still liable when we put them in that place of danger for other injuries, such as loss of consortiousness, basic statement of the law. I think once he knows that there's substantial certainty of injury, and that injury, according to Benight, not only be the apprehension of bodily harm. And surely my client, in my pleadings, he fearfully protested. He said, I don't want to do it. This is going to roll over. He was in apprehension of his bodily harm. That is an injury he was substantially certain to suffer, and therefore, the employer has to buy the whole case. And that is really how this makes sense, this case. We've got the case that we was looking for. We've got what
do you think your case is a stronger case or a weaker case than the night?
I think it is an equal case.
I'm just not very enamored of the Benight case. I assume that a lot of people went back in this warehouse on a fairly regular basis. I assume there was evidence that bats have gotten a bad reputation. That's what the batologists say anyway. That they very seldom attack somebody.
It's hard for me, Your Honor, to criticize the case I'm relying so hard on.
Didn't we say in REAP 2 that you can try to distinguish the knife limits its facts, and here you are trying to extend and ask you, well, forget about what you said at REAP 2 about that the knife was limited its facts, adopt just Levy analysis and say this was a functional equivalent to an intentional tort, and you're asking us to, even though we said the knife was limited its facts, you're asking us to extend it to this type of situation. Is that a fair assessment of your position?
No, sir. It's not because I haven't addressed Levy. I think...
Did you ask us to adopt just Levy's functional equivalent just a moment ago?
No, sir, I didn't know. What I'm saying is that Benight is limited to his facts. That's fine with me. I believe I have Benight case. I believe I can live in Benight. Reed, I can live under Reed also, under the simple majority. I'm not trying to ask you to say that gross negligence is functional equivalent. I'm going to abuse that. Admit Unfortunately, Your Honor, because I had to take that shot. But what I'm saying is, on element two of Reed, just taking a look at element two of Reed, does he know, is there summary judgment type of evidence, avoid a summary judgment against my client, that this employer knows that there's a substantial circuit issue? Staying right there.
Well, Reed 2 adopts the restatement, which is what you just said, and that is that the there was an intent to place the employee in a situation where injury was substantially certain. That's the restatement position, and that's what we adopted in the reading. Can you live with that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because I was at camera. Because I read somewhere in the brief that your client was asked a specific question, did your employer specifically intend to injure you? He said, no.
Okay.
Is that the case?
He said in there, in discussion, there's two people, Cameron and Walls. It's hard to keep them separate. They're both supervisors. Cameron, he said, I don't know. That's the exact quote from the deposition, I don't know. Now, Walsh, he said he didn't know any reason why Walsh wanted to hurt him. But then again, my client is not charged with minding him either on these little parties. That's still for the jury to decide to make that decision.
But he's the one that's bringing the client. This is a derivative claim. The wife stands or falls from the claim of the husband.
Right. And that's going to cause me all kinds of trouble from the jury. I mean, I'm going to hear that case back in. But I've got sufficient evidence to escape the summary judgment. Because we have Cameron stating his own state of mind, from which I get all the inferences of his maliciousness, of his ill will for the human being. I have all the inferences from that. They're mine. I'm a summary judgment. I know if I can tell you, I can stand in front of a jury, and a jury necessarily would give me this case. They might, might not, but that's for them to make that decision. That's a question of fact. And this is one of those cases where all the jury would find out what they have to say. But I have sufficient genuine issues of fact to get to the jury. Without asking you, gentlemen, to change the law. I'm not trying to be to push you on this. Now if I can make just the letting guardian, I want to do that because it does make no sense to me. If his argument was absolutely correct, narrow it, it would do this. If you have evidence of gross negligence, that is enough to raise a genuine issue of fact for some of the other persons. That is a narrow application of his case. And that probably isn't very good application. Simple. If I have real evidence of gross negligence, shouldn't a jury decide whether that's intentional? Is gross negligence an intentional injury such neat little containers in which we can pour every case perfectly as a matter of law? I doubt it.
We're having immense trouble distinguishing between gross negligence and negligence, as you may have noticed. Trial judges have troubles and lawyers have troubles. It seems to me that the intention versus negligence, no matter how gross, it is a much easier distinction to draw than once you ever start talking about degrees of negligence without an intent.
That's why I submit to this court that this is going to be a tough cause of action out there. This is not going to be easy out there in the application. I don't think this court needs to worry about the floodgates of litigation coming open. I read it on the book of 35, the 1974, where's the flood? And I don't think we're going to see one later. If we not, what I think is going to hopefully the Rodriguez ruling, which is, if we show actual knowledge, if you've got evidence of actual knowledge and summary judgment on the part of the employer that, looking back to the night of the day, gives some guidance from it, that one, that he knows that there's a dangerous situation, and two, he sends the employee into it, that for summary judgment purposes only is enough to get you a jury issue. And that's where I hope Rodriguez will reach when he comes out. And that's what that is our position. It's a limited operation, but it's enough to get me to a jury. This is what I'm here for. The intentional question, what Lady is saying is, when you get a situation, the thing with intentional, you have that substantial certainty element. And that's where the gross negligence starts blending into the intention. And that's where the problem's going to be. He's saying one way to solve it is if you've got evidence of gross negligence, that will be sufficient to get you to the jury issue. And that's what basically I think he's saying there. He goes on to make some policy arguments. It's made in the other brief. What purpose does it really serve, though? To tell employers out there that you can be grossly negligent, totally grossly negligent, and not be allowed to have a jury issue against you. What purpose does it serve to allow this kind of conduct out there on the street of South Texas, on the street anywhere? What purpose does that serve? Doesn't the legislative intent really say, let's protect this kind of conduct? I don't think so. I think the legislature, I think, wants to protect these employers. They want to make a deal. Did Juan Rodriguez make this deal in taking workers' comp? It's a deal. As I see it, you get it. Hopefully it's sure and quick compensation, but you trade in your common law action. And that's basically the workers' compensation deal. Did Juan Rodriguez make the deal, I'm going to go out there and allow my employer to put me in an absolutely dangerous situation and allow me to get hurt, and he knows, and I've warned him, but he forces me to either do it, get in the truck, or leave, or walk home. Did I make that deal? Is that the kind of conduct that's part of the deal? I don't think so. I think it serves the system. That doesn't serve the system, but it doesn't have dangerous places to work out there that causes injuries, which causes more complaints, which burdens the system. That's just letting our, I think it's a good common sense part. And we take a look at the deal that these people make. So basically, my argument is until I say it's time, I think Reed Tiffin stands. I think it needs a simple corollary under the guidance of the night that if you have evidence, actual knowledge on the part of the employer, if there's a dangerous condition, you put the man in to pass his understanding, his protestations, the night guidance there, then you will escape summary judgment. And that's all we're going to tell this court today. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from Ms. Fonda.
May it please the court, Mr. Harrison will begin argument for respondent.
Please, it's on the court. Your Honor, the reason we haven't seen the floodgates open since tonight is because we've got Reed Tool limiting the night to the facts. Please don't change the law of Reed Tool simply because there was a racial slur involved or allegedly involved in this case.
Why doesn't that raise a fact question as to intent to injure?
Your question is, does it?
Why doesn't it?
It doesn't raise a fact question as to intent to injure.
Doesn't that show some personal disregard for the individual as a person as opposed to the job situation?
Well, there's no doubt about that. Certainly it shows a disregard for the person and an individual, disregard for race. That has nothing to do with the job situation. That has nothing to do with whether or not his job is dangerous, whether or not the employer or anyone else employed by a neighbor wants to see this man hurt on the job. And to answer one of Justice Tech's questions earlier, there is no difference between driving a truck or being asked to drive a truck with ball tires and being asked to work on a machine called Jaws, as in Reed 2. With all due respect and deference to Justice Ray's hypothetical that he posed, there is no difference between being asked to drive a truck with ball tires and being asked to go down in a ditch and work on a high-pressure gas line.
That you don't see any difference between an inherently dangerous job, a machine which is dangerous by its very application, and many people are injured on it, but let's face it, more times people work on it and they're not injured than they work on it and they're injured, and it's just a dangerous design. You don't see any difference between that and an avoidable situation? Turning off an electricity line that's not otherwise needed, replacing tires that have obviously outlived their usefulness.
My point, Your Honor, is that I don't see any difference, and I contend there is no difference between those two situations when you're dealing with the question of whether or not there is a specific intent to injure. This court still requires, pursuant to the Reed Tool and the restatement, a specific intent to injure someone when you have an intention for it.
Wait a minute. Under Reed 2, we approve the restatement definition of intent.
Yes, sir.
You agree with that? It says
that
intent defines intent to mean that the actor desires to cause consequences of his act, or that he believes that the consequences are substantially certain to result from it.
Right, I do agree with that. My point is that there is no evidence of that substantial certainty in this case.
It shouldn't have even gone to the jury.
I'm sorry?
You say it shouldn't have even gone to
no,
the jury.
No, sir. There is no fact issue there. There is no evidence of a specific intent to injure. There is evidence of a specific intent to malign a human being, if that racial slur is correct, but that does not infer a specific intent to injure someone.
Was the Knight correctly defined?
Well, I don't think so. But I do not think that this court needs to reach that question in order to decide this case. Did you have another question?
I don't see any way that we can say Benight is correct and not see that this case shows stronger elements of intent than was shown against the person in Benight who told Benight to go to the warehouse.
No, there are much stronger elements in Benight. I mean, facts are distinguishable with the Benight case. In the Benight case, there was a warehouse, it was full of bats, and according to the evidence in the case, the bats were known to the employer to be back there. They were known to have rabies. they were known to have died of people. This woman herself had been previously bitten.
They weren't known to have rabies, though, where they kept it.
I thought I read that just this morning, John.
Well, you read it later than I have, then.
So there is the... That gets us back to your statement. When you're talking about the substantial certainty that an individual is going to be injured, you may have that. Arguably, you've got that at night. You do not have that here. There is no... Even with their experts at that the tires were so bald that you could be substantially certain that they may blow out. That is not substantial certainty that someone's going to be injured. Well, it's not. I mean, then you've got to have that when you're talking about intentional tort. Look, if you don't have that, substantial certainty that someone's going to be injured, you start redefining intentional tort to include gross negligence and then worse than that.
Yeah.
As Your Honor even pointed out, it's tough to decipher the line between ordinary negligence and gross negligence. When you blur that distinction between negligence and gross negligence and between intentional tort, then where are we going to draw the line? All intentional torts will become, or will embody and will encompass gross negligence cases. And we will see the floodgates open. This more than we can change the law.
Are you saying that if you're substantially certain that an accident is going to happen, that you cannot be certain that there would be an injury?
It depends on the accident. There is no indication, there is no evidence in this case that neither was substantially certain, or knew with substantial certainty that this man was going to be injured. The only evidence is an expert's affidavit saying that we
but,
looked at
but
the
But you're saying that you could assume that an accident would happen?
I'm sorry.
You're saying that you could still assume that an accident would happen under those circumstances?
Well, I am.
And you just don't want to take the additional step to...
I do not want to take the additional step, and neither did the Court of Appeals, and...
In Castleberry, in 1981, this court said that the injury caused by willful negligence or willful gross negligence is not an intentional injury. Are you familiar with the term willful gross negligence?
Yes.
And what?
What
does it mean?
Well, I would play a gross negligence. And I would agree with the holding, and I would agree with Reed Tool, where it states that even intentional failure to furnish a safe place of work, while it may raise the level of gross negligence, or willful negligence, is not an intentional tort. A problem, and the policy raises a problem that we'd get into if the court were to change the law, as petitioner is asking the court to do, is that we would be expanding the law to make employers liable for common law negligence and common law gross negligence. They are not liable for common law negligence so long as they subscribe to the Workers' Compensation Act. They have assessed for risk, they pay their premiums for workers' comp, and they should reap the benefits of workers' compensation protection. Not because it's the right thing to do, but because our legislature has given them that choice and was deemed prudent by our legislature. We should not take that away and say, not only now are you going to be liable for under the Comp Act, but you're also going to be liable for gross negligence and negligence, and we're not sure what all, we'll let you know later where the line might be drawn.
Isn't the statement walk or ride combined with the condition of the tires some evidence of intent?
The
statement walk or ride,
walk or ride.
Towards the other fact? Combined with the condition of the vehicle, some evidence of intent?
I would disagree that there is any evidence of intent to injure or see this man injured, or I would also disagree that that is evidence that they knew with substantial certainty his man was going to be injured. This was simply, as Justice Heck said earlier, that's something that happens on the job all the time. People complain about not wanting to do an unpleasant job, so the response is get out there and do the job. If you start holding employers liable for saying that, then that gets us right back to blurring that distinction between ordinary negligence, gross negligence, and intentional tort, and making the employers liable in addition to being liable under the contract, but liable for negligent injury that happened on the job.
But counsel, doesn't that argument say that there's no obligation on the part of the employer to have a good safety record?
He can just
injure employees all day long because he knows all he's going to have to pay is workers' comp premiums.
Well, certainly there's an obligation for him to have a good safety record. There are all kinds of penalties for failure to have a good safety record. There's OSHA. If he fails to have a good safety record, his workers' comp premiums will go up. If he injures somebody that's not employed by him, he can be sued by them.
all kinds of policy reasons why you can have a good safety record. The fact that we're refusing, or the fact that this court would hopefully refuse to extend Reed Tool to encompass this situation will not provide any detriment to the employer to do anything less.
But what if this is a preventable accident? I think that's what the court's really concerned about.
Well, it could have been. It could have been. But my point is that shouldn't be the inquiry. That should not, that's not the crux of whether or not this was an intentional tort, whether it was preventable.
Yeah, why don't you explain again? He says we're not, you wouldn't want to extend Reed 2. You live with that.
And you say that this would require an extension of Reed 2. Would you explain to me again why?
It would require an extension of Reed 2 because this is not an intentional tort case. And to hold the employer liable or hold that there is a fact issue in this case, whether or not there is an intentional tort, is going to extend Reed 2 for the reason that it's going to create fact issues of intentional torts in cases where there is not intentional tort, but only gross negligence.
Well, then, Reed 2, the employer did not require the employee to work on the jaws machine with the intent to injure him, did it?
No.
Just like here.
Just like here. He did not require him to drive a truck with the intent to injure him. That's why Reed 2 should apply.
But you said there was a difference.
Oh, no. No, sir. No, sir. I'm sorry.
What evidence would raise a fact question of an intentional tort in this case? What kind of evidence would raise a fact
question? That's a difficult question because you're always going to be in a position, and the planning board is going to always take the position that how are you ever going to get someone to admit that they have the intent to injure someone? I'm not sure I'm going to answer that question.
They're not going to sit around and say in an affidavit, we were talking and we said put Rodriguez out on old Baldy and we'll fix his wagon.
No, they're not going to say that. And I suppose there should be something less than that, exactly what it is. I'm not really certain, other than
we can get back to Benight, and what we at least had in Benight is a lot more than what we have here.
In Benight, you have that substantial. You do not have to get the employer to say, I intend to injure you. You've got to have the evidence that shows he knew or should have known or knew with a substantial certainty that the person would be injured. And in the night we have that with the rabies that had been attacking people, and we have the obvious intention of going back in there.
If an employer told an employee to drive across a bridge that had been washed out and there'd been a storm and the river was going at 50 miles an hour, that would be substantial.
You knew the bridge wasn't there.
No, I mean, you could see it over there.
And told him to go drive in the river?
Yeah.
I would say so.
I mean, so we just back up to whether or not, and you just have to decide whether or not bald tires on the Pathum, and we don't have these tires, get to that point where a reasonable person, where the jury could infer that a reasonable person would be thinking that would cause substantial injury. Substantially certain to cause an injury. And that's just, a judgment that court of law has to make.
Even more telling in this case, insofar as the evidence, or more pertinent, the lack of evidence that we have of intent is in Mr. Rodriguez's deposition, where he admits that Naylor was not concerned with or was not intending for him to be injured, but was rather intending that the truck get to a certain point by a certain time. That was their goal. Their goal is not injury. Their goal is a goal of getting the truck from point A to point B. And he was asked in his deposition, question on page 64, do you know of any reason why anyone at Taylor would want to see you injured? And his answer was no, sir. There is no evidence of a specific intent to injury in this case. The only intent in this case was to get the truck from point A to point B within a certain time.
But if that's a substantial impossibility due to the danger involved, then that rises to the level of intentional tort, like asking an employee to drive on a washed out bridge.
Yeah, if there is a substantial, if it is impossible due to the danger, it could rise to the level of intentional tort.
Is there any,
if there is that substantial certainty that making you go ahead and do it anyway is going to hurt you.
Is there any,
and for summary judgment purposes, we almost have to use a reasonable person standard
in the absence of subjective evidence, although the jury will be asked a subjective question when they hear all the evidence. Is there any testimony about when this, how much, when this truck had last been driven?
Not
from
the record.
What was the nature of the expert affidavit?
There was an expert accident reconstructionist retained by the plan who didn't look at anything because the tires were not available, the truck was not available. He reviewed, I believe, just the depositions and then these affidavits had taken in a few of the depositions and based upon what someone said about inner tube being visible through the tires. And I believe it was based solely on Mr. Rodriguez's deposition, that he could say with substantial certainty that if that was the case, then the tire might blow out. And that was it. Your Honor, there is just simply not sufficient evidence to hold that the fact issue in this case. This is not an intentional force. It cannot be said by any stretch of the imagination to be an intentional force. It was negligence, may have even been gross negligence, but it was not intentional. There was no specific intent to injury. Would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Any questions?
Thank you, Tom.
Well, there's a few things I wanted to come to discuss. The night was not overruled. It was limited to the fact situation presented in the night.
I think that's good for night facts.
In fact, to look at Benight, if we start preparing the passage, as I was earlier discussing, in Benight, the real damage to this woman was blindness coming from the subsequent rabies shot. My guy is not just afraid of being hit by that or bit, he's afraid of being run over a large truck. There's a real apprehension of danger. I cannot see how Juan Rodriguez sitting out there with a less apprehension of danger falling into a large truck with worn tires that he's going to drive.
In the night, did the employer have knowledge that these bats have rabies?
I don't think that's in the case. And if I was looking through the night, that wasn't mentioned. And she did communicate to him that it was a bat infested area.
And she was attacked, by the way, by this bat. It was gone in her hair.
Previous to her being sent back in there. And then she was bitten. I would state that my guy's in a little stronger position. These tires are bald, Timmy's showing, it's a huge truck, and I've got to drive it down the road. He's in danger of death. He did not die, he wasn't even injured. I'd be just saying, I can get into Benight very easily, I believe. And that, if it is held to its facts, I've got the facts.
But his apprehension really is of no consequence to your case, is it? Isn't he entitled to recover or not entitled to recover, whether he was apprehensive or whether he went to the slaughter like a lamb?
I think that is exactly right, Your Honor. I'm only saying that because it hit me so easily in the night. But then it's assault case. And I believe the benign, effect of benign, really, if you read
and benign
together, you see these two elements. But if you have an assault, if you're going to try an assault case, you better pay attention to benign. Because it is re-operating in an assault environment. Because there's extra elements in assault. That's why Benight is really different from Reed in assault. One is because you have an assault being trying to interpret. And he's trying to get you extra elements. That's really the distinction in the case. I'm talking about his apprehension because it fits me into Benight. Mario really breaks down to, I fit in Benight, I make it under Reed. And this is a summary judgment case. You might have heard the final jury argument today. They might be good jury officers, but I have to raise one genuine issue of material fact. I got Mr. Cameron saying, slurring this man, showing ill will toward him. Notwithstanding, he's put his patients throwing him into a dangerous situation, and he's hurt. It works like a charm.
If he had been a little more polite, would you have a harder go of it?
Yes. And that is frankly true. I would have trouble, because he shows maliciousness. I mean, to say that, Your Honor, the best evidence of state of mind is a statement of mind.
Why isn't that statement just
gross, willful gross negligence, as this court said in Castleberry.
Yes.
That term, I'm sorry to waste your time, but the term just hits me. I cannot quite figure out what willful gross negligence is.
Well, look at Castleberry. I think the thing of the phrase limited to the pleading. And what happened in Castleberry, they failed to plead intentional. The plaintiffs simply failed to do it. And the court threw them out, says, we're in the business of intentional injury here, and you're gone. You can't just talk about willful and gross. We pled intentional. All the way through.
We talked about it, so
all the way through. I think that's where we stay, Castleberry. Castleberry talks about pleadings. And I know it's a difficult line. When you start getting into substantial certainty, when you start getting this culpable mental state, which this man shows us. We keep talking about what kind of evidence do I have to have. If I can't win with this evidence, it's a funny, what do I have to have? I happen to have this law saying, hopefully I'll take it for it, that I intend to hurt this human being. Let's get Rodriguez. I'm going to, that's, if you don't mind, the price of preservation of evidence. I'm simply never going to get it out there. This is the good evidence that you're going to probably get in these cases. That's what I'm going to be in front of the jury. Let the jury decide if this is intentional.
The comp case has been resolved, right?
Yes, so that was resolved sometime ago. And this is simply the wife's consortium. And I ask this on this other question. What deal did Juan Rodriguez make in workers' compensation? Well, in that first family, what deal did he make? He didn't make the deal that I'm going to jump up on. He forced to jump on a truck in the middle of the country and forced to drive a dangerous truck in his vehicle. That's not the deal. This doesn't serve workers' compensation. It's totally protect this kind of conduct. There's no service here. We fall in on the balance. We use the case of the balance of the interest of the claimant to have the potential force and the interest of the system. A good balance. The next thing I'd like to say, there's been a lot of understatements in this case. Closing counsel, and sometimes in the opinions you see, getting into this large, huge truck with Volvo tires and tubes sticking out is no pleasantry. I doubt rolling over in this giant truck is no pleasantry. It's dangerous. It's going to kill this man. It's more than a pleasure. Juan Rodriguez was not asked to conduct himself in an unpleasant of his job. He was told to go into a dangerous condition that his employer knew about a substantially certain injury. That's not an unpleasant. And Juan did not sign up to work in high lines for the electric company. He signed up to drive a truck, which his boss had a duty under the law to say.
After the first blowout near Schulenburg, they stopped apparently several times to inspect the tires to see their condition. Having stopped and so inspected the tires, do you feel there was still a substantial certainty of injury?
Yes, sir, because they didn't stop the trip. I think that makes it worse. Here we get out and we see the cracked tires and the problem. And initially, Your Honor, after the first blowout, that truck is incredibly dangerous to get on. Because what we have is we have four wheels and back of one missing on a very heavy truck. Our expert advocate does talk about that. But this thing is substantially certain to go. This truck is going to go. And so what we have is an incredibly dangerous situation. I think additional inspections simply raise the level. I think he not only does once, now goes two or three more times. The truck got incredibly dangerous. Now we have bald tires and a tire missing. And Juan, by the way, says in his deposition, it's against the law. It's against the law to do this. But now we're up north of Schulenburg. It's not like Juan can walk. What is he supposed to do? And if Reed was looking for a set of facts, we've got them here.
But in the brief filed by respondent, after the blowout at Schulenburg, he does not say he was threatened with loss of his job if he did not continue.
Those words were not used.
No, it just says, do your best, but there were no threats.
For a walk.
After the second time?
Well, sir, there's several instances in there. They're hard to keep separate. The first instance is Mr. Cameron's racial slur with the horrible walk, which they're out in such a situation. And then they get on the road with the tires being cracked and tubes sticking out and all that, and the summary judgment. He has the first blowout. Juan then waits for the next morning. I think he walks, actually, here we have a walk into Schulenburg, which is a town pretty far away, a good step away. And then the supervisor comes. He sees the situation. The supervisor says, take the tire, one of the tires on the back, four tires on the back, to the front, and move it to the front. Juan's response in this is, that's against the law. I'm not supposed to do that. Do it anyway. Juan asks, send for another tire. No. No, we're not going to send for another tire. He follows him and he tells him, try your best. You know, Mr. Wallace is the same thing, just nicer. He's just nicer about it. But he still puts this man in substantial certainty of injury. And, you know, and he's just sweeter about it. But not that you don't have this terrible statement. What makes my case so strong, and what beats the genuine issue of fact that I have a statement of ill will and malice for this human being that the jury can decide he is intent to hurt this man. I'm not.
It's a functional equivalent of a testimony.
I don't go as far as just leaving this chair. I'd like to go with just leaving this. I like that law. I think that'd be a better law policy-wise. I think Rosenthal just ought to get us past certain judgment. And that's what I think Rosenthal should simply give us the genuine issue of fact. This is to a jury. But that's not necessary to my case. We don't have such strong evidence elsewhere.
The problem, Mr. Weber, is why this case will impact other cases.
I'm sorry, sir.
The problem is whatever you write here to solve your problem will impact other cases. And if we start saying that gross negligence is a functional equivalent of intentional tort, then we'll have to pay for those sins.
You can, the Rodriguez case, as I would read the Black Law letter from the law coming later, the Rodriguez case can say that in the circumstance when you have evidence of actual knowledge on the part of the employer that the situation is dangerous, and the employee protests, and notwithstanding that, is forced into that situation, then you escape summary judgment against you on the intent question. You have a jury issue. It can be written that way. And people, I don't think plaintiff lawyers are going to read this and say, oh boy, well, we better file everything. Because that's going to be a tough standard to hit. That's going to be hard to do.
What does the statute, I'm sure they're in the breach and I've just missed it, but what does the language of the Act say? And how does that...
The Workers' Compensation Act?
Yes.
But I'll have to look for it myself. It talks about exclusivity of actions against the employer. And the courts have decided but not intentional. And that's the only way we're in here.
But it has the words, but not intentional. But
I'm trying to, Your Honor, recall this. And I have to apologize.
But I don't see it in either brief. It appears that, just from what I do see in the brief, that some other states have been more... In other states, gross negligence actions can be allowed, but I would assume there's a different language of the Act, but I don't know, and I don't see that developed.
I think our Act applies only to intentional torts, and we've adopted the definition of the restatement of intentional torts. And we,
yes, sir. I can live with it. I think my facts are so egregious to live with it. The other thing I'd like to address. We keep talking about during argument, on the side of my verbal comments, but there's no intentional tort, well, how do we know? How do we know? A journalist needs to decide that. I've got enough evidence of this mouse. I have enough evidence of, no, it's against the law, don't do this, I don't want to do this. Put the man in the truck, if they come to the jury decision. So say we can't just stay here, it's a matter of law. No intentional tort. What does that do to me, in effect, if that is the law? If we come before this court and another court of summary judgment, it makes me have the burden of proving as a matter of law that I do have intent. I don't have to do that on summary judgment. I have to raise a genuine issue of fact. And put evidence before the court showing we got facts. And we need to go to a jury. And I think that's what we have here. There's some statements about Corpus Christi in the depositions that the main intent was to get this thing to Corpus Christi and not to harm it. So we take a look at the deposition, though, and read it in context, and I want to read just a piece of it. The exact quote from this gentleman was, my client to him was on page 34 of the deposition. Is there any truck, another truck you can give me to drive back out of here? I told him, you can see the tubes on the tire on that truck out there. What did he say? He said, quote, you damn Mexicans, all you do is just bitch. He said, that truck has to go to Port Lavaca and then got to be in Corpus Monday morning. In the context of the deposition, yes, he said, I want the truck in Corpus. And this is, you know, the court wants this truck moved. But he's also told that there's a problem. He's told that I'm in danger. You're endangering me. You can hurt me. And his response is, mouse, ill will. That's a jury question. That's a jury question to take before the jury. That's all I have.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess.
Counsel, please rise.
Thank you.
The court will take a brief recess.